this is one of our favorite outdoor explorers. It first aired in July of 2014.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth.
We're learning these days that just about everything we do has an environmental impact, and that applies to outdoor recreation, as well as indoor city activities. Ironically, outdoor folks often are highly attuned to being good environmental stewards, yet we know that cities save energy and handle waste with advanced procedures. Our topic today is how we can reduce our impact in the wilderness. I'm sure you've heard about Leave No Trace camping. We're going to talk about that and all aspects of having a light tread on the landscape, a lot of which is about education. And we've got two educators in the studio today. I'm hoping for a broad-ranging conversation about wilderness ethics and about sort of passing on how we feel is the right way to be outdoors to, you know, new generations and new people. And to do that, I've got two exciting guests. Tracy Dumais is a field instructor with National Outdoor Leadership School, better known as NOLS. Thanks for being with us, Tracy.
Thank you.
And Jillian Morrissey is program manager with the Student Conservation Association, perhaps better known as SCA. And thanks for being with us, Jillian.
Absolutely.
So just to orient folks to your organization, SCA, you're working with a lot of kids in terms of building trails and spending time outdoors and becoming familiar with their abilities and their potential and contributing to the community.
Absolutely. Yeah. So our mission is to take young people into the field and do hands-on service where they get marketable skills that can then be transferable to careers, hopefully, in the mm-hmm. outdoors.
And I want to talk much more about that. But I also want to begin with focusing on why this is important. And maybe it comes down to a particular moment when you've been outdoors and you see something that bugs you. I know that when I'm out on the water and I come ashore and I'm going to be camping and I find a dirty fire ring where I was thinking about being in the wilderness and it being sort of my special place, that really bugs me and diminishes my sense of it. But there's a lot of other aspects to this too. And Jillian, you were talking about the fact that the way trails grow and get wider and look worse and worse over time because of kind of too much love.
Absolutely. Yeah. So one of the things that we're working on, Mount Baldy Trail in Eagle River right now, and it's a well-loved trail. People in Eagle River love being able to run up Mount Baldy. And it hasn't been on my radar. And then as we started to work on this project, I started noticing driving on the Glen Highway north, you can actually see the trail from the highway. And just because it's a really steep trail, which is fun for mountain runners, but it's also a really easy access to a mountaintop. People are essentially loving it to death. And there's some sections that are 50 foot swaths of erosion right now. And so we're working on how can we reduce our impact and still love Mount Baldy and make sure that we have that access up to that easy access mountaintop.
Mm-hmm. So what would be the solution to that?
We're doing some reroutes, making sure that we still keep the challenge there so that mountain runners still feel like they get that the challenge they need to be able to prepare for like Mount Marathon or for the Matanuska Peak runs. But what we see a lot of is families up there. So it's just better access. It's a much shallower grade so that moms with children and three or four children in tow can enjoy it just as much. And it's not so slippery, which is kind of a safety thing, especially during when we get these huge rainy spells.
Yeah, well, we get these trail sections that are steep that are kind of like mud chutes. And so you start out with something that was kind of just started out as an animal track and then mm-hmm. more people use it. And it feels very kind of backcountry. But then as enough people get using it, it just turns into a big, nasty mud chute. And then you have to think about how do we improve this trail? And in some sense, maybe feels a little bit less wilderness when a really well-built trail. Yeah. But if you look at sort of the national parks, the sort of the places where people have been hiking for 100 years, there'll be stone steps. There'll be, you know, it'll be really improved to the point that, so it's kind of a funny balance, isn't it?
It is. We're always playing with that balance. And when people have become accustomed to it looking a particular way, even if there is things like a lot of erosion, it's their trail. They love it. They want to keep it the way it is. They don't want it to be overdeveloped. So we're always balancing that. We're trying to protect the resource, trying to make sure that people still have access and also make sure that they still get to enjoy what they love about that. Mm-hmm. And so it's a delicate balance. But we work on it constantly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everything is work. You can't just let it go, right? Tracy, you are teaching a lot of kids and adults at Knowles. And I noticed you were nodding when I was talking about finding the fire ring on the beach, you know, and what a bummer that is when you feel like you're in a special place all your own. And actually, there's almost nowhere you're going to be that people haven't been before, right? But you'd like to feel like that way. And I was wondering if you had any sort of memories of things that sort of bummed you out or that motivated you to want to really have a high wilderness ethic that you teach.
Oh, certainly. I think my favorite thing is being on remote expeditions for, you know, up to a month and trying to go where no one else has gone before, or at least share that experience with our students. And I think one of the things we're focused on now is we have operating areas that we return to, but we also want to make sure we don't use them too often, and even seeing our own impact in areas of, oh, I know courses have camped here because, you know, up in this area on the Matanuska Glacier, the winds can pick up and you have to build rock walls or create safety, and just trying to dissemble that when we leave so that it feels when you receive or get to this place that no one has been there. And I think that's something that students then can carry back in their front country lives, whether it's a city or the city park they go to, and leave the place as they had first found it, is really important. So I've had many instances in various places here in Alaska, and also I work a lot in Patagonia with Knowles, and seeing impact when other people just leave trash or toilet paper tends to be a popular one. So figuring out how to dispose things.
One of the grosser things to find, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, sort of doing my own true confessions. I have been out in the Sound, and you will come upon some hunter camp where they've just left massive amounts of stuff, and they feel like it belongs to them, and they're going to come back every year, and it's really can be pretty gross. But then one year we were out camping, and we camped in the beach grass, and we came back like months later and realized, oh my gosh, the grass that we trampled is still trampled. You know, we messed up that spot for the entire summer. And so started to recognize that, you really have to be pretty aware of the vegetation and what that place is all about. And it's not just people who are cretins who don't care if they ruin stuff. It's like everybody sort of has to have some education knowledge in order to not mess stuff up for others.
Oh, I agree. And I feel like it's something we approach each time we get to a new campsite of, where do we want to camp? Yes, these are rocks, but it's going to leave a much less impact than if we camp over there on the grass, which is more comfortable, and choosing where we cook. And I think visibly seeing an impact when you climb a peak up in the Chugach. Recently, I was in this area called Turtle Flats, where you can see the Matanuska and the Glen, and then you can also see Prince William Sound. And you just see our camp area of all these footprints, and luckily they're going to be gone. Mm-hmm. Briefly, but it just, if you carry that to the moraine camp we had and our impact with heavy mountaineering boots that will last for a while, and, you know, trying to see things differently. And when we leave, our impact is still there.
Yeah, yeah. And you can't have no impact. I mean, as they say, leave only footprints. Well, footprints are an impact too, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you, you should tell, I want to talk about how you start to instill these kinds of ethics in your students with both of you. But Tracy, tell us a little bit about Knowles and what it is.
So the National Outdoor Leadership School, students, our shortest courses are 2 weeks, but a typical expedition is 28 days. And ideally, we focus on one skill type to really create independence and competence so that folks can ideally travel through the wilderness on their own, if I'm speaking specifically about a backpacking course. And so we begin everything through role modeling. And I think our instructors go through a month-long instructor course where our main principle is just role modeling, respect for the lands and respect for ourselves because we live and cook together for an expedition. And I think that's how it starts, is just approaching a place and figuring out why we're going to camp there and how we're going to camp there, because every campsite is different, whether there's a large river or to dispose of wastewater versus why might we dig a sump hole in this place, or if we use rock rings to set up our tent, is it important to us to disperse them the next morning? And I think I value working with Knowles because as an instructor, you can choose what you really care about and have conversations openly with our students, why something is important to you, and starting to hear what is important to them. And the duration of the course allows people to develop their own interests and passions of what really matters to them.
Yeah, and you mentioned the duration. Talk about like where you go and how long you spend.
So we do expeditions in Prince William Sound, typically starting either in Whittier or Valdez and going as far south as the weather allows or just across the sound, taking time to stop at various places. We do a lot of backpacking courses in the northern and southern Talkeetnas from east to west. And then we do mountaineering courses, mostly in the Chugach or the eastern Alaska range. We also have a couple expeditions on Denali every year. And so our semesters, which is probably one of the greatest things, it's mostly college students. And we're trying to create where they see the diversity of Alaska. And so they'll paddle in Prince William Sound, and then they'll either backpack in the Talkeetnas and mountaineer in the Chugach, so they get to see all these different biomes and environments and how they're connected. To this year, we have a rafting course that will start in the Little Nelchina to the Taslina, across Taslina Lake and down the Copper River to Prince William Sound, Cordova, where then they'll paddle to Whittier. And so I think, Wow. Yeah, students, it's an amazing expedition. When they get to see all the areas they travel through and how they're connected, I think they start to develop a sense of place and then care about how they're leaving it.
Yeah.
So I believe strongly it takes time to appreciate the places you're in because, it's, you know, our students receive so much from the views and their experience with people that they in turn go and sometimes want to pursue an internship with the SCA or other organizations and give back.
Yeah. And it takes time to become, I mean, you're trying to change a person's point of view. That doesn't happen in a week. I mean, and actually spending, I've often found that, you know, it's only after 5 days or a week in the wilderness that I sort of shed all of my sort of urban perspectives and sort of get into the space. So how many days or does a typical student spend in one of your programs?
I would say typical 28 days. Mm-hmm. So it's 26 days out in the wilderness in a tent, which is impressive for, I think we have...
For anyone.
Anyone, but I believe we have, this year we have over 55 courses, so we'll have nearly 700 students.
Just in Alaska?
In Alaska.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, and we operate all over the world. And so currently I think we have 12 expeditions that are 16 and 17 year olds only, and it's just impressive that either they choose or their parents encourage them to sign up for this 28-day journey where... Mm-hmm. You know, they're going into the unknown and
they're going to come back different.
It's true. And I have seen it and appreciate that. I think folks even reflect more after their experience mm-hmm. and how many alumni get in touch with us or want to come work for us and with us.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
It's a great program. So it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I've got two guests with me. We're just hearing from Tracy Dumais with Knowles, the National Outdoor Leadership School. And Jillian Morrissey with Student Conservation Association is also in the studio. And we're talking about a much broader topic than the heading would suggest of leave no trace or reducing our impact on the outdoors, which turns out to also have a lot to do with ethics and with how we teach kids and how we teach each other that we want to behave when we're outdoors. And so it's a big topic and an interesting and somewhat philosophical one. So, Jillian, Tracy was just talking about Knowles and how that program works. You talked very briefly at the beginning about the SCA, mm-hmm. but tell us more about how students get involved and how you sort of induct them into your point of view and your way of doing things.
Sure. So, there's SCA Alaska, where we do some of our own things up here, which is fun. And one of the things that we do is actually bring a lot of young Alaskans onto our programs. So we have about 100 positions this year where Alaskans are participating either in internships or on our conservation crews, our trail crews. One of the things that we do with them up here is actually do an orientation program where before the summer season, they come spend either a long weekend or a week with us and get introduced into outdoor education. Because one of the things that we've realized here in Alaska is that programs like NOLS or SCA, where folks are out away from home, out away from the services and things that we have, it needs an introduction for some folks so that they feel better prepared once they hit the field.
Not too much culture clash of saying,
exactly.
Where's the toilet? Right.
How do you brush your teeth outside? How do you deal with hygiene and things like that? And so we do an introduction period so that when their program comes and they go on a 38-day program, they can be more successful more quickly. And that's been one of our keys to success here, especially for Alaskans. But something that I really love about SCA is we were created by a woman named Liz Titus Putnam, and it was back in 1957. And we were thinking about the wilderness ethics. She was looking at the national parks back then and recognized that that was the parks were being loved to death. And she said, "Wow, why can't these college age students come out and support our parklands? There is all this work to be done. They can have that camaraderie. They can have that experience. They get to be in these beautiful places." So that's where we were born out of. So we continue the spirit of what Liz created back in 1957, where we really want young people to get into these places. It's amazing how many Alaskans, especially when we work with our urban population, never have been to Denali Park or down in the Chugach National Forest.
It is extraordinary. Yeah. So what ages are you working with and how long do you take? You know, you break down your program, you do the service project and you do a wilderness trip. How does all that work?
Sure. Well, it can get confusing because we have essentially four different programs. So we have what we call the young adult side of the house, and then we have the youth side of the house. So on the young adult side, we have these individual place internship programs. There's about 120 of them in Alaska, but there are hundreds more down in the lower 48. I think we have about 1,000 young people serving in internships right now across the country.
Wow.
And then also on the young adult side, we have what is called our CORPS program, C-O-R-P-S. And the CORPS program is a team-based model where it's typically 18 to 24-year-olds who serve anywhere from 3 to 10-month programs. And they work, of course, they work all over the United States as well, but we actually have three CORPS programs here in Alaska. On the youth side of the house, we have our national crew programs. And so that's the program that I work most directly with. And those are 15 to 19-year-olds, and we have 30-day programs. So 21 of those days are where they're doing their service project. And then the rest of that is their recreational trip and then travel home.
What kind of recreational trip do they take?
It largely depends. Most often, that's the opportunity that those youth have to do with the backpacking. Because our crews, they are more typically base camped. So we're in one place. We're in a fixed point working on a specific trail for that 21 days. The rec trip is an opportunity for them to go see Resurrection Pass or to go do Kasugi Ridge. And that's their opportunity to have that self-reliance with just a backpack and going out and having the experience that Knowles does. So that's one of the big differences between our organizations is we typically stay still and have to practice leave no trace in this very impacted base camp.
Which could be another very challenging thing. In the second half, I think we're going to get into sort of how you do it, right? Give the listeners some tips. But I'm interested in terms of, Tracy talked a little bit about kind of developing this point of view among the Knowles students or the Knowles, you know, the people are going on these trips, and getting them into understanding why it's important. Do you see a similar thing with your students of kind of getting them oriented towards leaving no trace and being environmentally positive when they're out there?
A lot of times, because conservation is one of our big missions, a lot of folks don't even know what that means. So a lot of times we're just breaking young people into, okay, this is what conservation means. We have these public lands.
It's not inexhaustible.
Right.
It can be used up, right.
And there's work required to keep this all up. There's mm-hmm. the folks who manage things like pit toilets. There's the folks who keep up the campgrounds and make sure there's wood stacked. There are rangers. There are people who even work in the accounting department. That's all conservation work. It just depends on what your area of expertise or how you participate in it. So a lot of times we're just getting our members educated on what conservation work is, that it's beyond just being a park ranger. Mm-hmm. And then it's the getting them through the most of our young people have never worked an 8-hour day. And part of our program, part of the hands-on service to the land, is learning how to pace yourself through an 8-hour day of swinging a tool.
Oh, this is hard work.
It is.
I bet you get some
exhausting.
Really sore kids at the end of the day.
Absolutely. But it's also super empowering because they'll come back and they've got the first calluses on their uh-huh. hands ever, or they break in those pair of work boots that become their loved pair of shoes.
But there's got to be some who say, get me the heck out of here.
Oh, yeah.
Give me back my iPod. I want to be a office worker.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's okay. We want people to find a good fit. And I would say attrition is usually people self-select. If it's too much, they want to get out of the field, and that's okay. But for the folks, for some, it's like you can actually watch the young people, their eyes open. It's like the first time they've ever really been awake to the world that's around them.
And contributing as well as just consuming, right? I mean, they're actually trying to make it better.
Absolutely. And they're proud of their work.
Oh, I'm sure. So you mentioned Mount Baldy. Give me a couple of other examples of projects where you are trying to sort of mitigate the love to death issue or anything like that.
Well, let's see. We're everywhere. So Denali National Park right now, typically folks don't think about trails in Denali National Park. They think of it more of as a wilderness park. But there are so many visitors that come just to that front country visitor access area. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to provide access to places in Denali National Park. And they have a professional, they have their pro trail crews. And we work right along beside them trying to open up that access and protect those areas and make that trail that sacrificial scar so people know where to go.
So you're essentially, you know, improving a trail so mm-hmm. that it's more clear where people are supposed to be walking and
yep.
and maybe they won't end up in a mud bog so they won't go around it and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's great for wildlife stuff too. Mm-hmm. Just we can get folks to where they're in a better place for either viewing and also just not sneaking up on bears and things
like
that.
I noticed on that Mount Rapinski trail there in the front country, this was a few years ago, but that it had turned into a spider web of casual trails. And you get enough people there that it's the whole mountain basically is trampled at that point.
And so
at that point you've got to narrow it down. People
absolutely.
Have got to go one way.
Yeah. And the tundra doesn't bounce back quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when we're especially working in the tundra, where we really try to define it clearly. Knowles does such a good job of spreading out their use when they're out in the backcountry. And what we see where we're in the front country sites where the tundra is, we really need to designate it for folks. Mm-hmm. But we're also working we were on Resurrection Pass North. And that is a loved trail. There are a lot of folks recreating on that. So we're trying to make sure that all of those visitor access areas are kept up and maintained so that people can continue to love it and that it works, that the trail is actually working and protects the land around it.
That's fantastic. So we're going to take a break here in a few minutes, but when we come back from the break, I want to get more into how our listeners can be better backcountry users, how they can learn to do some of these skills that you guys are talking about in terms of making sure that the next person comes along doesn't know they were there. And as we talk more about, with Tracy Dumais from National Outdoor Leadership School, one interesting aspect of this is mountaineering, climbing Mount McKinley, Denali, and the issue that's happened over the years of stuff being left behind, and that's something that has to be dealt with. And so we're also going to be talking with Jillian Morrissey from Student Conservation Association more about teaching young people and getting them used to these concepts and what sort of misimpressions people might have that need to be dealt with. So that's all coming up in the second half of Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
This next piece comes to us from Will Davis. Will has been a cheesemonger for Fromaggio's and is currently the sake master for La Bodega. Will was yet another victim of the rampant bike theft in our town. His bike was not a high-end, full-suspension, or fat machine, though. It was a 1989 sentimental piece of steel. This story comes to us from the Trail Tales storytelling event.
Hello. I'm Will. And one thing I've learned tonight, and you will all soon learn, is that I'm the least cool person on this panel. These people are all really awesome. I have never bike packed or done any work to improve trails or build trails. I've never collided with a moose or a deer. And is my fly unzipped? No? Okay, we're good. And I've never held public office. But I just love my bicycle, and I love riding my bicycle like that Queen song. And I really, really love our trail system in Anchorage. And, you know, I ride my bike to work in the summer because I'm not that hardcore. And yeah, that's about it. It's great. So, where was I going next? My story is about a beautiful summer day last July where I rode my bike to work, as I'm sure a lot of you do. Oh, and I guess that's what I was gonna say, is maybe I'm like some of you out there who aren't amazing badasses, but just like their bikes. So I rode my bike to work. This was a lovely like 75 degree Sunday. You know, I got started at like 10:30 a.m., like easy sleeping basically, and got to work. And it was one of those days that's so nice that you just like rather be outside like shoveling poop than inside doing whatever you're doing. You know, 7 p.m. rolls around, I get off work and like lock the door and like turn around and my bike is gone. And just quick show of hands, who here has had a bike stolen ever? And who here just knows a friend or knows someone that's had their bike stolen? So it's definitely a problem. And it's the worst. I did what anyone would do. I got on my phone and got on the like, you know, municipality like stolen item page and sifted through that and posted a thing. And, you know, I was just pacing around, figuring out what I'm gonna do, and just started walking home. And took the long way, you know, cut through every single side street in between 36 and Benson, and just made it a really long walk, and had those like fantasies of, if I see someone riding it, like, am I gonna run up and Chuck Norris them like off of my bike, and because that could happen, and or if I saw it in the back of a truck, maybe like do a sweet, you know, Tom Cruise like leap into the bed. And and that didn't happen. I just got home and didn't have my bike and stewed about it. And then I got on Facebook and I posted a picture of my bike and a bunch of awesome people shared it. And but still no bike. 2 days later, I think on Tuesday, I got a text from a friend of a picture of my bicycle, which I should tell you about my bicycle real quick. It's really cool. It's a 1986 Nishiki Olympic 12. And it's like teal and white. It's a total just queen of the 80s. And it's pretty sexy. But it's worth like, I bought it when I was like 15 or 16 for like $175. Not really worth anything. And I always kind of thought the old timers were safe around town, you know? Could just lock it up or leave it unlocked and it'd be fine. But not the case. But anyways, I got a picture of this truck with my bike in the back of it. And it had the license plate. I even could see the cross street. It was on Jewel Lake and Diamond. And but I was like in a meeting at work and couldn't like do anything about it. So I'm just sitting there for like 2 hours, like tapping my foot, like, let's get this over with so I can call the police. And I do that and I give them the license plate number. I'm like, we've got a solid lead on my bike. And the person's like, yeah, that truck is stolen. So that lead was gone, basically. But that night, I just drove over to Jewel Lake and Diamond, and it was pouring down rain, and I just drove around for like 2 hours down every single street and like in people's driveways and just looked like an insane person. Probably looked pretty sketchy myself, like I'm scoping out this neighborhood, but just drove around looking for my bike and still to no avail. But then the highlight of the story, I guess, is the following Sunday, I'm at work, just the same shift I was the day my bike got stolen, and I get a text from my friend who was on break from work and just, you know, saw my bike in the Fred Meyer parking lot on Northern Lights and like Seward Highway, which is about a block from where it was stolen. And he's just said, "I have eyes on your bike, what should I do?" And I just responded, "Call the police, please, and like, here's the case number." And APD showed up and they got my bike back. Yeah. Go APD. And so I talked to the officer on the phone, and I'm a dummy who didn't know my serial number, but I just described it in, I guess, enough vivid detail, like the shade of teal that it is, that he believed me. And they brought my bike back to me, pretty much not ruined, which was great. And that's it. I just kind of, I had basically at this point written it off as gone and somewhat irreplaceable. It's not a modern bike, and I don't know, I've never seen another one, but it was, you know, one of those things where you're just like, someday I'll see that bike. And maybe some of you have that feeling about your stolen bikes, like someday I'll see it. And it's always possible. I guess the moral of my story is just stay resilient and stay vigilant and keep riding your bikes, and thieves are bad. And that's my story.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org. This is one of our favorite Outdoor Explorers. It first aired in 2014.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth, and our topic today is leaving no trace. That is, using the backcountry in the wilderness and having the next person who comes along find it as good as it was when you came, which is can be more of a challenge than you think, and it's a really important part of keeping the beautiful places that we use as beautiful and meaningful for the people, for everyone. And certainly something that you appreciate when you... it's one of those things that you appreciate having a place that looks like you're the first person there. You don't necessarily think of the person who made it that way. You think about the person who made it that way when you get there and you find something nasty, something you don't want to find. So it's a kind of a what you may call a value of making yourself invisible. And we've got two great guests in the studio talking about this and about the other aspects of it. How do you pass on these values to kids and to other people who are just beginning their outdoor careers? Jillian Morrissey is a program manager at the Student Conservation Association, and Tracy Dumay is a field instructor for National Outdoor Leadership School, NOLS, who travels the world and is kind of a nomad. She calls Alaska home, but she's only here for 4 or 5 months out of the year because she's also in Antarctica and Chile and everywhere. So Tracy, let's start with kind of some of the basics. What do you need to teach someone who's going on one of your trips who maybe hasn't spent much time backpacking or sea kayaking? Some tips that we could give to listeners who might be wondering, like, what are we talking about here? You've got certain human functions, sleeping, cooking, going to the bathroom, and you need to think about all of those and how they don't leave a mark, right?
Correct. I think the first thing I always like to remember is it's an opportunity to go with few things so you can just enjoy the place you're at. And I know on our website we have expedition planning tools, but the main one is...
We have that website on our site at alaskapublic.org, so people... And everything we talk about, you know, go to alaskapublic.org, check out today's show, and you'll find all the links. But I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, go ahead, Tracy. Okay. Thank you. is to just realize whatever you're taking into the mountains, you're also taking out. Mm-hmm. And so food planning is really important to us of what are you actually going to eat and how can you get rid of prepackaged wrappers and stuff so that you're not carrying them into the backcountry. We do a bulk ration system where we just take some pasta and cheese and try to be creative with how we cook. Some other folks I know, you can buy dehydrated meals and that works really well. But remembering to take out all of our trash is the first place to start.
Right. So if you take that Mountain House envelope with the freeze-dried food in it, or there's other brands as well, it's very convenient to cook in the envelope, but then you're stuck with an envelope for the rest of the time and you've got to get rid of it somehow, which is carrying it on your back, possibly.
Exactly. Yes. And if you're interested in ultralight techniques, which some of us are, if you want your cup of tea, you can even take out your... dispose the tea wrapper and just take the tea bag itself. And by organizing, you can go in the mountains with less trash and less weight.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. And then going to the bathroom always seems fearful or scary, or maybe I just won't go these few days. But it's actually
I bet that causes a big problem.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think it's something we speak about the first evening in the mountains and realize it's a human function. We have to do it. And pretty quickly, people buy into the idea of digging a cat hole mm-hmm. away from your camp and where you're eating and trying to dig, you know, a hole eight inches deep with a shovel or a little camp trowel or an ice axe and going to the bathroom, either using natural products or if you're going to use toilet paper, it is something we also pack out.
Mm-hmm. You don't bury it. Don't leave it.
We do not bury it.
It always comes back. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think something
you can burn it, I guess.
You can burn it. Some folks do. It can also be rainy a lot in Alaska. It
can be difficult to burn. Yeah.
Right. But is remembering that we're not only there for the aesthetic reasons for other people, but also animals and not wanting to impact, you know, the caribou or moose, anything. So I think just really remembering to try to disguise your going to the bathroom is really important. And also looking into local rules and regulations, different parks, for instance, on Denali, you know, you have to take a CMC or your own personal bathroom can. And there's only certain places you can dispose of that, or you have to carry it all the way and it gets flown out. Mm-hmm. And so making sure you know the regulations of where you're going is really important.
So in some places you're told to do it like below the tide line, you know, in other places they don't want you to do it below the tide line.
Exactly. Yeah. And it all plays into
staying away from streams.
So exactly. Yeah. Yep. Stay away from water. And if you're going to dig a hole, hopefully you're digging into relatively organic soil so that it can decompose faster. But of course, that's not always the case. And so it's thinking about what is going to happen when you're gone and what is the best way that hopefully the least amount will be left. And that varies where you are in the world. And always thinking about those things, whether you're in a desert environment or a temperate rainforest or up in snow, it makes a difference.
Well, I think finding toilet paper is maybe the most unpleasant thing to find. It happens all the time. I mean, look on the side of any highway in Alaska. I mean, we could actually install toilets, but that's another subject.
Right.
But when you talk about using natural, you mean like leaves and stuff instead of toilet paper?
Rocks can, like smooth rocks are popular. Also, snow is one of the great ones, even though it's cold. And I would encourage people to be careful with leaves. You know, Devil's Club is not that pleasant.
Or Pushki,
exactly.
You can end up with a rash, right?
Right. And, you know, smooth sticks, like an old cottonwood branch. And we even teach, as they do in most countries in the world, is using, you know, your hand and a bottle of water and obviously making sure you wash your hands really well. But I think that brings in a cultural awareness, which is what we also do at Knowles, is teach about people and how you interact with different folks who have very different upbringings and cultures, because we work all over the world. And I think that in itself can seem scary and weird, but when you explain that toilets don't exist in many countries, that there are pit holes. I think that in itself opens students' eyes to just what is out there.
Right. I mean, there's a sense that we're imprisoned by the toilet. I mean, the people, you feel like you got to be around a toilet or you're like, you don't know how to deal with reality. And I feel like that's something that you learn outdoors in Alaska pretty quickly, is that actually you're a mammal like all these other mammals and you can go anywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what about hygiene and washing up? I mean, that's a significant issue outdoors as well, and probably something you also have to teach students.
Yes, and that starts right from the beginning, whether, you know, we each carry a hand sanitizer, just to remind people, if one of us gets sick, typically everyone will, because mm-hmm. we're living so closely. And, you know, using soap before and after you go to the bathroom. And also little tips such as, we will have a plastic bag of snack food, and instead of reaching in there, we always roll down and you pour snack food into your hands.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, you know, whenever we're near big rivers, encouraging people to wash your feet and rinse off to make sure you're staying clean.
Mm-hmm.
Along with, I think some people, I joke with my dentist, who I send random pictures of me brushing my teeth everywhere. He is impressed. I probably have better dental hygiene in the mountains than I do in the front country, which we call. And you just, depending, you can, you know, just broadcast your toothpaste anywhere, utilize large rivers or the ocean to dispose of waste. And I think it also reminds people how simple and easy those tasks really are.
Yeah. So you talked for a moment about Mount McKinley, and there was over the years, I mean, it used to be climbed by half a dozen people a year. Now it's climbed by more than 1,000, and they can't all leave their waste everywhere. So you need procedures that are dictated by the Park Service, and essentially it means you're carrying your waste on your back and getting it out of there.
Exactly, which I think is excellent, and it's something we're seeing in more places in the world on these trails, as Jillian says, that are loved, or these mountains that are loved, is we want people to share in that, because then they have other avenues of giving back. And I think regulations are needed when there's just an overcapacity of people in one area. Mm-hmm. And so it's something I know they speak about every year, of what is the best practices, how many people should climb, and really encouraging folks to stick to those regulations.
Right. And you were talking about these treks and mountaineering you do in Antarctica. And that's, I guess, a different business. And we've got that on the website as well. But that's very remote. You don't really have to worry about anybody finding anything out there, right? So it's a kind of different way of dealing with it?
It's different. And the Antarctic Treaty has very strict regulations that they don't want anything permanent there. And so a role of ours is to be really conscious of our environmental impact. And the company I work for does an excellent job on the mountain. We manage, there are very few places that you can pee. We have pee holes, and the same thing, we use WAG bags. You carry down your own waste,
mm-hmm.
and even specific places to camp, so that the impact is really minimal, because it's a desert and things do not go away.
Anything you leave is going to be there forever. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it's something, I mean, I'm really impressed with the way we manage the mountain, and less folks climb it than they do climb Denali, Mount Vincent.
Mm-hmm.
I would say just over 125 people a year climb it. It's one of the world's highest seven summits, or the highest on Antarctica.
Right.
And so we have pretty strict regulations, but that's so that we can continue to operate there and just share that really remote place with people.
Mm-hmm. So that was Tracy Dumais, as a field instructor with Knowles. Jillian, you've got sort of different issues with Student Conservation Association, because you're setting up a big field camp for lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that could very well look permanent once you leave, unless mm-hmm. you're very careful about it. How do you go about doing that?
It depends on where we're working. We have a lot of partnerships with different agencies. So we'll work with U.S. Forest Service, National Park Service, state parks. We even work in the municipality of Anchorage. So depending on where we are, depends on where we camp. ideally, we usually have a remote site where we're on our own and not having to interact too much with the public just because we have a different program of what we're doing. And those are typically called gypsy camps where trail crews come in and it's sort of designated for field camps so that it's more geared to what our needs are. But we can have anywhere between 8 to 10 people in a camp. And so just the tracks around even a kitchen or things like that, we have there for quite a while. We're there for over 21 days, typically. So in the places where things are designated, it's great. We know we're supposed to make an impact in these places, and so we designate that as an impacted area. If there's a place we're going and we're traveling to different field camps or different sites, or we'll call them spike camps, and no one is coming in behind us, we'll actually do restoration on those sites. And that's something that we actually teach the youth is how to, okay, we've created an impact here. How do we then make the environment so that it can spring back? So if that's, if we trample down the earth and we compact the soils, we'll actually re-aerate the soils and even reseed sometimes if it's the right time of year for seeding. And try to disguise and hide so that it's like we disappear and that the land can spring back really easily. Mm-hmm. So depending on where we are, that will then determine what we do with our spike cams and with our base camps.
But it's a focus and it's something that you're trying to pass on and inculcate in the kids that you're working with.
That's part of our curriculum. Yep.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to teach. And so that they feel it. Actually, listening to Tracy, it's so great because I feel like so much of what we do sometimes with young people is get them away from feeling imprisoned into the front country, that they can be empowered to live outside and be self-reliant, and that these systems can be really simple and that they can be freed up to do other things in their life. And I feel that's a lot of what we do is try to take a look at the systems that they exist in and then figure out how to show them a way to live outside and feel like they could do it all on their own and that they can take care of themselves.
And it's not necessarily like taking home outdoors, right? It's like like being in that place. Yeah. So one thing we didn't touch on too much is like placement of your tent and how, where you're going to set up your tent. And Tracy mentioned a little bit in the first half of the show is like looking for a rocky area rather than, vegetation that's going to be damaged.
Mm-hmm.
There's some trade-offs though with that, and I've noticed when I've been in the Sound that some of the Knolls people will be like sort of constantly moving their tent because they're trying to camp in the intertidal and the tide comes in, and that doesn't sound like a heck of a lot of fun. I mean, talk a little bit, both of you, about how you choose your campsite to minimize impact.
You guys move camp more often.
It's true. I think a quick motto that I constantly think of and try to instill in my students is good campsites are found, not made.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the conditions, you do want to enjoy your evening there because it could always turn into several evenings. But just thinking about what is it going to be like when you leave. And maybe you see someone has clearly camped here, then it's probably also a great spot. Mm-hmm. And so let's keep impacting that one area.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Be aware of the other areas. And so, yeah, I'm not saying do not camp on vegetation, but I just think being thoughtful of where and why you're choosing to camp. And in certain areas, they've instilled or made tent platforms in Prince William Sound.
Right, Surprise Cove.
Surprise Cove is a great example of that's where you should camp. That's what they're trying to encourage for many reasons, for your comfort, really, but also for the impact and erosion.
And you find that places people have camped, as you say, they're good places. Also, you're not going to make it any worse. You might make it better because a lot of times you'll look around in the grass and you'll find that people left garbage and there's other debris, and you can, if you have the capacity, you can take some of that out and actually improve the place.
Exactly.
We do a lot of work just because we are in such impacted sites all the time is that micro litter.
Mm-hmm.
And Knowles does a great job of trying to reduce their trash coming in. And but one of the things that we find, just getting people accustomed to the fact that with wrappers and things like that, picking all those little things up that are everywhere, so that even if it is an impacted site, it can be clean and it's not a hazard to wildlife where you might habituate bears or things like that. So there's ways of creating making those impacted sites so that they do stay clean and nice. And
just when you're on a day hike, you open this granola bar and everything you've got has got a million different wrappers.
Like
you
say,
you gotta be thinking about containing those. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about reducing our impact on the backcountry with Jillian Morrissey from the Student Conservation Association and Tracy Dumais from Knowles. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the educational component of this in terms of passing on this knowledge and spreading it to more people, because it's one of those things that's totally cultural. There's no enforcement. There's no rule that you're going to be able to go out and follow people around and make them do this. So it's they've got to want to do it, right? And either because of, you know, what motivates people? Well, they might be embarrassed that they're being jerks, or they might really believe, you know, in wanting the place to be good. And so I got to thinking about the name of your organization, Tracy, National Outdoor Leadership School. And I mean, part of the whole concept of training leadership is one that seems like it's easy to see how you train somebody to do arithmetic, but training them to be a leader is a bit harder. So talk about how you do that. How do you train someone to be a leader and to believe in these values you're talking about?
Well, luckily, I think the environment helps facilitate that pretty quick, because consequences are real and immediate. And the amount of decisions our students and instructors have to and get to make on a daily basis are real and genuine. And often as an instructor, you won't step in, where if you feel like you've supplied the tools to read a map, you will let students learn through the experience. And I think, unfortunately, that doesn't happen a lot in traditional classrooms nowadays. There is always a right and a wrong answer. And so having people be proud of their success and okay with their failure is what we do. And so we have different skills we focus on, such as self-awareness and communication, or tolerance for adversity and uncertainty. And really, on a daily basis, we see every single one of those come out, whether it's figuring out how to communicate with your peers, who's going to cook dinner, where should we put the tent, that all of these things are topics we debrief on a daily basis and speak about during our expedition.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's what we're doing, is we're just trying to make the best people. And so it's through that time and duration out in the wilderness that we foster these skills.
So one of the things that's come up on the show as we talk about sort of things that have gone wrong on trips is, well, if there's nobody who's in charge in some level, if there's no decision-making system, then when you're in a crisis, sometimes you just won't make the right decision, even though everybody sort of knows what they should be doing. If you haven't figured out how you're going to make the decision, then you've got a problem. How do you address that? Do you like think about a trip needs one leader, or do you think about like how you find consensus, or how do you address that point of view?
That's a great question. We work a lot with the Naval Academy now, and I think that is one thing they're very used to, is a directive leadership style. Mm-hmm. But acknowledging that there are times, especially in an incident, where you do need that directive voice. Mm-hmm. Yet there are different models, whether it's consensus or consultative or a vote, and what decisions should be made when. And that often depends on safety versus like what's the likelihood we need this decision now and what's the consequence. And so our vocabulary is very transferable into other people's lives. But I think we're trying to acknowledge that on a daily basis, you're acting as a self-leader, just taking care of yourself, your own hygiene, your own basic needs, to you're supporting your peers, setting up a tent, choosing camp, to sometimes you are the one creating the activities and figuring out the route. And those are real decisions that we empower our students with, that there is no right or wrong. We might have a goal to climb a peak or to get picked up at a certain roadhead, but it's also okay if we don't make it to that roadhead. Mm-hmm. There's other options, because it's about the journey and not simply the destination.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you look at Alaska Native people, especially Eskimo cultures, there's a sense of leadership is earned. You know, the Umiolic is this guy who's actually has shown himself to have these abilities.
Right.
And so there's no sort of coercive leadership. It's like, yeah, that's the guy I want to follow. And so maybe this is part of what you're talking about in terms of developing leaders who show good qualities that others want to emulate.
Exactly. And everyone has a different leadership style. You can lead from the back, or you can be that strong, outspoken voice.
Yeah.
But we all lead very differently.
How do you address that with the younger students you have at the Student Conservation Association? Do they develop their own leaders, or is it kind of more directed from the instructors?
So trail work and conservation work is our metaphor that we work through. So where Knowles has the expedition to utilize for that as their workbook, and as they go out and learn, getting the goal of finishing the project, the service project that they have in front of them, and running a good, clean camp is what they use. And so through making sure that everybody is healthy and safe and doing well and reaching their goal on the service project, that's how we teach leadership, and that's how we try to inspire leadership with the young people. Typically, though, because most youth don't know how to build a bridge,
right.
We do, and they will learn.
You need to do it right the first time.
We try to make our leaders do have that sort of ultimate decision-making authority on how the bridge is going to be built, and they use the youth to help them get there.
So I think and both of you can chime in on this, it seems like a challenge that I can immediately think of as a parent of teenagers is, number one, breaking away from electronics, which is, I think every parent now is really trying to figure out how to deal with that. And number two, sort of relationships and issues, interpersonal things that would happen in camp between teenage kids. And so, Jillian, how do you guys deal with those issues?
One of the first things that we start off with program is all the cell phones and smartphones and other electronics are collected. So we try to remove that.
Not an issue. Yeah.
Except for most youth now, their phone. How do they take pictures? It's with their phones. So we've had this really interesting interface right now where youth are like, well, I want to take pictures. And well, of course you do. This is an experience you want to remember. But then that means that cell phone is right there. And so there's a lot of places, even out at Spencer Glacier, that get great cell phone reception.
Yeah,
so
that's spreading everywhere. Yeah.
Right. So that's something we're trying to figure out. But typically what we try to explain is that we want them to immerse themselves in the program so that they really have an opportunity to work on communication. And we talk about how elusive, good, effective communication is. And that this program is an opportunity to deal with conflict that arises, how you do that well and make it growth oriented, and so that young people come out of it with better skills to handle life.
Yeah, and that's kind of a good ending point. I imagine, Tracy, that a lot of places you go are so remote, it's not even an issue.
Right. I would like to
say, and we're just about out of time, unfortunately. Yeah, but go ahead.
Right, but students come back and their favorite thing is not having their cell phone. And so I'm seeing this shift of if it's not there, they appreciate time with people and having real conversations.
Yeah, that's true. I sure feel that way. Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of times I wish I could not have it. I want to thank both of my guests. That was Tracy Dumais, instructor with the National Outdoor Leadership School. And we also heard from Jillian Morrissey, program director for the Student Conservation Association. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.